Welcome to Worst Year Ever, a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
What? Allegedly biting White House aides, my Joe Biden's German Shepherd.
Poorly trained dog.
Rescue, I mean, or just an excited puppy.
So
we don't know the extent of the biting.
And the Oval Poffice Twitter account has come out to say that there was no bite. So this is a real mystery.
The unofficial, like, dog parody account of the president's dogs.
Yes, it's horrible.
God, I hate everything that just got said.
I will state for the record a couple of things. Number one, regardless of what happened, Joe Biden's dogs have done nothing wrong because they're dogs.
Because they're dogs.
Good boys and girls.
Yes.
Very good.
Yes.
Good puppies.
It's not a great place for a German Shepherd. The White House.
Or was it Major?
It was Major.
It's the new one. The baby.
Well, and also, you know, German Shepherds are guard dogs, and they are slow to warm up to people. If you have a friend with a German Shepherd, you know this, that it takes them some time to get acclimated to you, because that's what they're for. They're supposed to protect people. They're
little
not
Nugget
good.
Had a lot of people around and maybe got a little overexcited.
Right. Yeah. Well, then don't bring it to the White House.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a bad don't place bring the little Nugget to the White House.
Like, it's just like, We did a lot of, everyone had a lot of fun about, like, how Donald Trump doesn't have dogs and what does that say about him and stuff. But, like, just don't bring your dog to the White House.
Or if
for this performative, like, if it's
I disagree.
A problem.
I think maybe this dog is.
I think there's types of dogs. Like, boxers, I'm sure, would do well at the White House because they just want to be surrounded by people all the time. A German Shepherd is not the kind of dog I would bring into that
I don't think
sort of
we need to
keep it in the residence.
I don't think we need to pick a breed about it, but. I mean, like,
you're going to say corgi, aren't you?
No, I'm not going to say corgi. I was going to say
you're going to say corgi.
I was going to say sometimes corgi. If strange people come into my space and I don't like them.
I bite people all the time. Absolutely.
People too, is what I'm saying.
I taught my dog to bite. I say bite me and it nibbles on my finger.
So
that's
I guess
not quite true.
All I'm saying is Anderson would fuck a bitch up. So, like,
everybody's...
you know, live with your dog, but don't put them in situations where it will be bad.
There
this
we go.
Maybe
a
intro,
high traffic.
This intro belies the seriousness of our interview we have coming up.
This episode is going to be mostly about anti-Asian American violence in the United States. We have a great interview on that subject. First, before we go into that, I want to make a quick note about some folks who could really use help. The Tenacious Unicorn Ranch is a ranch, an alpaca ranch in southern Colorado that is also something of a sanctuary for trans people. And their existence discovered maybe the wrong word, but a bunch of local bigots and militia people realized that they exist and have been threatening them, breaking into their property at night, armed, sending them death threats, making it unsafe for them to go out in the community nearby. They're attempting to mobilize resources. They have some volunteers who are coming over to help already and sending some things. But they have a GoFundMe that has currently raised about $41,000 of its $100,000 goal to both better secure the property and to provide them with resources, since it's not super safe for them to work in the immediate surrounding area right now. Hopefully they'll be able to get past this. But I wanted to plug their GoFundMe. If you just type into Google GoFundMe, Help Our Trans Haven Alpaca Ranch Grow Phase 2. Again, that's GoFundMe. Help Our Trans Haven Alpaca Ranch Grow Phase 2. If you have some bucks to spare to throw towards it, what they're doing is really great, and they could use your help. We'll be talking to them soon, I hope. But yeah, I just wanted to kind of direct some resources there. If you have, anything to spare.
Yeah. Thank you, Robert. And we can share that on our social media, too.
Yes. All right, let's hear about violent racism. All right, this is a worst year ever, which you already know because we will have already introduced the show at this point. I'm a train wreck at the moment.
We're off to a great start.
You're high speed rail. You're fine.
Yeah, I
think
I love
you guys
high speed
great.
Rail.
Everybody's great.
Thank you.
Nobody's good. Nobody's good.
I know.
But
I
you know who is
great.
Good?
Everybody's great. Exactly.
I said great, Robert.
Thank you. Well, speaking of great, our guest today is great. We're going to talk with him about the terrifying surge in anti-Asian hate crimes in the United States. His name is Christopher Wong, but if you're on Twitter, you probably better know him as the Ice Must Be Destroyed guy. Which is your legal name, right? That's on your driver's license and social security card, right?
Yeah, it's slightly awkward at family gatherings because every time, you know, normal name, Ice Must Be Destroyed, dude.
Yeah, I mean, you are from the Northampton Ice Must Be Destroyed, right? Like,
indeed.
Yeah. Christopher, that was a fun intro, but this is not a fun topic, and it's something that, sorry, Cody. It's more hate crimes, and I don't know, maybe terrorism, light terrorism. I don't know where the line is here. This is a subject that I think we're all kind of aware of the edges on, which is why I brought Christopher on, because he's been doing a deeper dive on this. But I think if you've been paying any attention to kind of the news lately, you've caught bits and pieces of, and it seems like a lot of it's kind of driven by COVID-19, but there has been a really unsettling rise in hate crimes against particularly elderly Asian Americans. Christopher, do you want to just kind of talk about what you found in your research into this, because it's not something I've seen a really solid, comprehensive article on yet. I'm interested to learn kind of the dimensions of this problem as it exists right now.
Yeah. So let's start in 2020, because a lot of what's happening now is a direct product of a lot of stuff that happened at the very beginning of the year when COVID had sort of just started. And what you saw basically was, instead of, you know, doing the thing the government was supposed to do, which is, hey, we should prepare for this plague, everyone saw the pandemic and went, aha, this is our moment. We've got it. We've finally got the CCP over a fire. Right. And you know, what starts happening there is you get almost immediately people calling it the China flu, you get the Wuhan flu,
yeah.
You get like the more racist variations of it, like the Kung flu. Very quickly, a bunch of stories start circulating about how this is because of wet markets, and there's all this sort of fear-mongering about Chinese people eating bats, and it's really terrifying. And, you know, this spreads very, very quickly to a lot of people who are incredibly powerful and who have enormous platforms. Donald Trump does this a lot. It takes a surprisingly long time for him to say Kung flu. Like, it takes like 8 months, but, you know, he's talking about China flu and the Wuhan flu and the Chinese flu almost immediately. There was a social media study done of people who were pushing it. Tom Cotton, by far the worst. Also Bill Hagerty, sort of surprisingly making it in there at basically number three after Cotton and Trump. Yeah, but, you know, this spreads like wildfire across the sort of right-wing media. Tucker Carlson's obsessed with it. People on Fox News are doing the bat stuff. And, you know, the disturbing part of this is that a lot of sort of liberals get in on it. And the liberals, there's some people doing the concern trolling about, oh, it's okay to call it the China flu because it's just geographically where it's from.
Yeah.
But
because calling the last influenza pandemic the Spanish flu had no consequences whatsoever.
Yeah. You know, it's like, oh, this will be Americans are totally not racist. This will be completely fine. And
also that started in Kansas, by the way. So
yeah, it's great. You know, and there's the sort of China watcher community, like Spalding, gets in on it really quickly. And there's a particularly, I guess you could call it a just Western conception of nationalism that's spread across the entire world, where it works by sort of conflating just the people who live under a state, the state itself, and then those people's race. And so all the attacks, a lot of liberals thought they were just attacking the CCP, but you know, what turns out to happen is that everyone reads this basically as an attack on all Chinese people. And, you know, and then because racists are not very smart, and essentially don't care, this very quickly turns into a whole bunch of attacks against just any Asian person anyone can get their hands on. So in 2020, I mean, this is, and I need to make this clear, this is a very, very partial list. There have been we have no idea how many attacks there's actually been. The Stop AAPI Hate, which has been the people, the activist group has been tracking these since they started in March 2020. So they missed a lot of the early attacks too. They've recorded like 2,800 incidences of sort of either racist rhetoric or attacks, 100 physical attacks. One of the first ones, there's like several stabbings in February. There's one of the first ones that caught the news was actually in April. A woman was just going back to her apartment and these two men poured acid on her face.
Jesus.
Where
was this?
That one.
This was in Brooklyn.
Brooklyn, yeah.
Yeah, there's another, I guess we can jump to the second Brooklyn one. New York has been an epicenter of this violence. On July 14th, 2020, and this is another one of the points where you start getting attention to it, even though it's been happening for like 6 months by this point. An Asian American woman is lit on fire in Brooklyn. There's in Midland, Texas, on March 14th, a guy just stabs a family. There's two children. One of them is age 2, one of them age 6. And this guy just stabs them, and he's yelling about how, quote, he thought the family was Chinese and infecting people with the virus. There's in California, some of these aren't drawn from news reports because nobody even covered it. But I mean, there is someone who had a report of a white family tried to like run them over. Like they were on the sidewalk and they drove their car up on the curve to run them over when they saw they're Chinese. This continues through 2020. It kind of sort of seemed to be slowing down towards the end of the year. And then 2021 started and everything just kicked up again. On February 4th, there's this is going to be another one of the trends. Like one of the most common things is you have elderly Asian people just sort of walking around, just going for their homes, just, you know, trying to go about their lives. And people will just run up and shove them to the ground, just push them over. And on January 27th, a man named Vicharadanapakdi, who's 84 years old, he's Thai, he's a grandfather, and he gets pushed to the ground and killed.
Jesus. And where was that?
This is in San Francisco. There's a very similar incident in Oakland in Chinatown from a 91-year-old dude who thankfully survived, but the same person attacks like three other people. I think that the earliest this year was the day before the Capitol riots. In Oakland, an Asian woman got shot in the face with a flare gun.
Wow.
Jesus.
Ugh. Yeah, you know, I mean, there's all of... Yeah, it's horrific. You know, the sort of...
I mean,
like, just the range of violence, like...
Yeah, the different methods and stuff. Like, one of the things this is saying to me is that it definitely seems like a situation where COVID is the excuse, not the cause.
Yeah.
Because it would be one thing if these were all just, like, people yelling at, like yelling out, like, racist shit about COVID and then, like, throwing a punch. But, like, acid flares, like, that's somebody who's thought a lot about doing the specific kind of racist violence and wanted to do it in the cruelest way possible.
Yeah.
I've been thinking a lot about that, like how we're seeing this now, but these seeds have been around for so very long and it's such a huge topic to unpack, but it's an important, obviously it's an important one right now, but we're having these conversations, a real conversation about racial reckoning and, you know, Black Lives Matter. And throughout the summer, through all of this, it's felt very hard. Because it feels like that if we're having a conversation about Black Lives Matter, which is, of course, its own thing, its own entity, but we need to be having these other conversations as well, because racism against one group affects all, you know, it's all very interlocked. Sorry, that's a bit of a tangent here.
No, but. I mean, but and like racism in the United States against Black people, there are systemic aspects to it. I mean, this goes back. We've talked about this on Behind the Bastards a couple of times, but there have been like eliminationist tendencies against Asian immigrants in the United States going back to the late 17, early 1800s. You know, this is as old as the country is.
And there's the myth. I'm not sure if I'm saying this right, the phrase, but the myth of the model migrant. You know, and how a lot of times
model minority.
Minority. Thank you. And I'm sure you could speak more to this, but that setting up of a pitting different races against each other, you know, as to who can be the most American. Anyway, it's a lot to unpack.
Yeah, I think Well, one thing I need to get out of the way, please, I am begging you all, for the love of God, do not under any circumstances, do not use the hashtag Asian Lives Matter. Just do not. Just don't say
that,
it.
That's a thing that started happening.
Yeah, people have been doing this. God. Do not do this. It's disrespectful. It's frankly racist against Black people. Yeah. And you know, the other thing, there's a lot of stuff about how, you know, this sort of turns activism into this sort of like trend. It's like, oh, one month is this lives, and next month is like, no. This is not how this works. And the other thing that's very important about this is that it specifically screws over Black Asians. Mm-hmm. Who are having a terrible time, and you know, especially globally, like, you know, one of the things that's been happening in the last, I mean, this is a struggle that's been going on for half a century, but you know, particularly in the last 2-3 years is the struggle in West Papua against, you know, West Papua is a colonial possession of Indonesia. The Indonesian police have been just murdering people in the streets. The Indonesian army has been deployed there because people have been, you know, trying to break free of this colonial army. And you know, when you're doing this sort of like Asian Lives Matter stuff, you're screwing over them. You're screwing over, you know, just don't like, please. God, yeah. I'm begging you all, stop. Don't do this.
I mean, that's deeply frustrating. But also, like, I guess not surprising. I hadn't heard of that going around. And I, you know, it's a problem that, like, I guess we run into every time we're reminded in the United States of the different kind of the different sorts of bigotry and violence faced by different ethnic groups. Is this, like, there will always be people who try to lump everybody in the same basket just because they're all facing some sort of bigotry and violence, which it's kind of like, I've been hearing a lot of complaints about the term BIPOC from Black activists that I follow, and about how we're like, we don't want to be like, I'm not BIPOC, I'm Black. I don't want to be lumped in because I'm trying to speak to specific problems that my community is facing. And I feel like this is kind of a liberal way of just throwing us all together in one lump, as if, you know. Anyway, I've been thinking a lot about that. Obviously, I'm the whitest guy ever, so I don't I don't want to be like throwing my own opinion out there because it doesn't matter on this. But I'm trying to listen and understand that, and it what you're saying makes a great deal of sense. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, that sort of ties back to the origin of Asian American as a term, which, you know, almost no one like in the Asian community even sort of remembers this, because. So the term itself was created by a bunch of activists it was largely student activists in the 60s who were sort of, they were reacting to the war in Vietnam, they were reacting to the national liberation struggles, and they wanted to have this term that could pull all of the different sort of different Asian groups together to sort of, you know, like the thought behind it was that, you know, the whole, this is the moment of the Third World Movement, and this attempt to sort of pull all of the sort of Asian peoples together, and, you know, and it was also directly in solidarity with the revolutions in places like Algeria, and the sort of revolutions happening all over Africa. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thought is that all these people are going to walk into the future together with, you know, this is how we're all going to free ourselves by fighting alongside with each other. And this, you know, this kind of collapses because, I mean, one of the big problems is that, okay, so if you're a Chinese person, you're a Vietnamese person, right? What do you do when China and Vietnam go to war in 1978 and 1979? Like, that whole thing sort of implodes, and no one, you know, and it gets to the point where no one even remembers the origins of it, right? And now it's sort of weird because that politics that was pulling all of these groups together is gone. Like, it's basically imploded. There are people who will tell you it's still around. It's not. It's dead. And so the only things that Asian Americans, you know, especially when you sort of lump Pacific Islander in there, the only thing we have in common is that white people want to kill us. Like, that's it. That's the whole source of, like, the term Asian American, is we're from vaguely over there and they want us dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's really grim in a lot of ways.
In every way.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that we just, you're right, bleak. A lumping together a wide swath of people under one term that have wildly different experiences and backgrounds. Yeah. And yet we just say you're, yes.
Yeah.
The Asian American community.
Yeah.
There's also, so I will say, I think there is, you know, there's a lot of debate of whether we should keep using it or abandoning it. But, you know, one of the things it does track, though, is that, yeah, you know, one of the big things that Asian Americans have in common is that their countries have been invaded by the U.S. Okay. And so, and you can
a lot of people track have this. That
common. Sounds like trauma.
Yeah, yeah, but, you know,
it's a generally non-American experience.
But you know, I mean, and you can actually track this in the victims of these killings. Like, so one of the people who I didn't mention the first time is Noel Quintana, who's a 61-year-old Filipino man who was slashed across the face with a knife. Jesus. You know, yeah, the Philippines is one of the the U.S. U.S. occupies the Philippines for half a century, fights this unbelievably brutal war that they kill somewhere between 200,000 and a million people. They have concentration camps. And, you know, so while the U.S. is there, they're in the Philippines, and they go, hold on, wait, we have troops here. We can use this to invade China. And so they do during the Boxer Rebellion. It's originally this thing. It's like, oh, we're gonna put troops here to safeguard Americans. And then that turns into the U.S. like breaking down the gates of the inner city in Beijing. And, you know, you can keep doing this.
Yeah, we brought up democracy or something, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. we brought them... So we reinstalled the emperor. Mm-hmm. Like, it's great.
The democratically elected emperor.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, you know, and this could, like, there is another... I think this is the most recent. I could be wrong about this because, again, these attacks keep happening. One of the most recent ones was there's a Japanese woman who was... just beaten unconscious with a rock, like apparently a
good
rock
God.
And a sock, just like smashed
good
her face in.
God.
She's like attacked her boyfriend too. Yeah, and you know, okay, so Japan, I mean, we nuked them. We did Japanese internment. The Vicharadnapaktis from Thailand. In Thailand, we didn't actually invade Thailand. We just allied with their military dictatorship. Yeah, you know, and we tested war crimes on peasants.
Tomato, tomato. Mm.
Yeah, that wasn't Suharto was Indonesia, right?
Suharto. But you know, one of the things that like Charles Murray winds up working for the Charles Murray of notable wrote the Bell Curve fame winds up working with the Thai government. And, you know, and I want to point this out, the Thai government is so evil that them working with the bell curve guy, like, reflects badly on Murray. Like, that's how bad the Thai government is in this period. Horrible. Like, yeah, you know, and this is the kind of violence that is being inflicted. And, you know, and part of what we're seeing here is American sort of geopolitics reflects back on people in the United States. And this is a big thing. And this has been one of the big sources of the violence we're seeing now is because, again, of the sort of nationalist conflation of the state, the race, and just the people who live there, right? All of the China COVID stuff, and then all of the sort of increasing tensions with China. There's no actual... nothing on the American state side will ever be done against China, right? Like, ever. It doesn't matter whether you think it's good or bad. It will happen.
And this is one of the things that frustrates me so much about, like, the tankies, kind of some of the people on the far left who want to pretend that, like, nothing's being done to the Chinese government isn't doing anything terrible to the Uyghurs or whatever, where it's like, this is just warmongering. People are trying to drum up interest to invade China. It's like, no one's going to invade China.
You know, China's nuclear weapons, but like even when they didn't have nuclear weapons, the USSR, like they had a bunch of war plans for invading China, and they figured they couldn't do it because even with nuclear weapons, they couldn't kill enough of the population to stop like human wave attacks. Like, and the USSR is literally right on the Chinese border. There's no war between the US and China. And the other reason is because the Chinese and American ruling classes are completely intertwined. Like,
absolutely.
China owns $1.1 trillion of American bonds. Like, you know, they've invested $1 trillion in making sure that the American economy keeps running. Right? Because you know, all American Chinese supply chains are completely integrated. The Chinese manufacturing sector is based on making sure that the American dollar is worth way more than, you know, than the Chinese currencies. And, you know, but, you know, so what is the result of this, right? There's constant sort of ramping up of rhetoric about China, right? But nothing will ever be done because, again, the American Chinese ruling classes are intertwined. So what happens, the people who pay for that, and both Democrats and Republicans do this, right? They do this sort of like, here's our cheap shot at China thing, right? You know, and it's like, sometimes it's like China is doing horrible stuff. A lot of times, like Joe Biden, for example, a couple of weeks ago made this unbelievably racist joke about Hu Jintao, who was the former Chinese president's name. Yeah, no one reported on it. No one. It was basically something. There were two tweets from reporters. The press corps did nothing, right? And, you know, Trump is, meanwhile, is doing all this sort of racist stuff. And the people
What did Biden say?
Yeah, what was the comment?
It was Hu Jintao. Yeah, that's really his name.
Oof. What?
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 Yeah, it's super, like, what? It's unbelievable. No one,
oh,
you know.
My God.
That makes me so frustrated.
Yeah,
Joe.
Because I just get... This is just a side tangent. I am very frustrated with the lack of accountability on our side when people we've elected do things. That would have been a headline, and we all would have talked about it for a day.
That would have been a solid week.
Yeah, well, you know, like, this is part of the election that I think most people have forgotten about now. But like, there was a point of the there was like 2 weeks where the entire election was Trump accusing Joe Biden of being like in the pocket of China because some business deals that Hunter Biden did, and then the Biden campaign was like, no, Trump is tied to China. It's like, yeah, both of you are rich. Like, of course, all of them are tied to China because they're rich, and the Chinese and American ruling class are all friends. Like, you know, and this is like. Yeah, but you know, the people who pay for the, like, you know, you get like maybe you get a 1 point poll bump, right? It's us, like, it's Asian Americans are the people who pay for that, and you know, it's also like Chinese international students and Chinese scientists, and you know, this is broader Asian scientists too. But it's like we pay with this with our bodies, right? That's the price of this, you know, this just like nationalist sort of warmongering.
That is such a good point. How it can become a political weapon, something that people use that might gain them some small margin when they don't intend to do anything about it. But I hadn't thought about it like that. Thank you.
Yeah, and this is something that, you know, whenever the American system goes into crisis, it does this. Like one of the, you know, I partially. You know, if you want to talk about sort of the Asian Americans as a sort of like buffer class, you know, a lot of the times this is part of what the model minority myth is about, right? Is Asian Americans as a sort of buffer class between white people and black people. And, you know, the British are incredible. When the British start importing coolies or these basically like, they're not quite enslaved, but they're basically debt peons. They're so indebted and they're continued to force, like, they're in debt to the companies who import them for work, and then all of their wages go back to the company. And
it's kind of an evolution of like indentured servitude, but among a group of people that have less sympathy in the American mainstream, the Western mainstream, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and when the British are importing this, they're incredibly explicit. They just straight up say this as we are importing these people as a buffer class. I mean, they literally say this, you know, and you get very similar things when the U.S. starts importing Chinese labor, particularly the build of railroads in the 1860s and the 1870s. But one of the things that starts happening in the 1870s, there's this enormous economic collapse. And, you know, from railroad speculations, it's like this is one of the like Great Depressions. And what you start seeing immediately is everyone goes, who do we blame for this? Oh, wait, it's Chinese people. Because, you know, there's like 80,000 Chinese workers in California. And so, you know, people know about the, I'm not going to say all people, but, you know, a lot of people are familiar with the Chinese Exclusion Act, which is in 1882, it bans all Chinese people from entering the country or holding citizenship.
I always bring this up. It came, 20 or 30 years after the United States government, because we were trying to bring in Chinese workers, complained to the Chinese government that human beings had an inherent right to change their nation of origin at any time.
it's actually worse than that, because a lot of people talk about how that was the first U.S. immigration ban. It turns out it actually was not. And this is something that I found when I was looking through the data on the reports of hate crimes. It turned out that, so I was expecting that more women would be reporting than men because of the way that sort of sexual violence works in like forming like Asian racecraft stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but okay. It turns out that 70% of the people who reported stuff were women, and 30% were men. And they didn't get responses from non-binary people or people who marked it down. But you know, this is an unbelievably lopsided ratios. It's the vast majority of people who are, you know, having these crimes against them are women. And, you know, it turns out this has an historical precedent. So in 1870, there's something called the Anti-Prostitution Act. And in 1875, there's another bill called the Page Act. And these are bills that are supposed to be about prostitution. It turns out what they're actually about is that the white people have decided that every single Asian woman, like every single Asian woman in the United States is a prostitute. Like all of them, they've decided that Asian marriage isn't real. And that, yeah, all these people are prostitutes. And because they're all prostitutes, they have to deport literally all of them. And so they do. And between 1870 and 1875 and the Page Act, they ban all Chinese women from coming to the U.S., which is the actual first immigration. Okay, so they say that their specific wording is, this is, it's between, this happens between 1870 and 1875.
Okay.
They, you know, they say it's like women coming for immoral reasons, but, you know, they think literally all Chinese women are immoral. And yeah, so they ban Chinese women from coming to the country, and then they deport like everyone who's here, just like, you know, they do ethnic cleansing.
They're banning prostitutes, but also legally defining every Asian woman as a prostitute. Yeah,
that's really interesting to think about in context of our current fetishization of Asian women.
Yeah, well,
this ties into something that people aren't talking about, but I think really should be, because I don't think you can understand anti-Asian violence without it, which is this unbelievable wave, even in the last 10 years, this has been happening, like, worse than before, this incredible wave of violence by the police against Asian sex workers.
I haven't heard anything about this.
I mean, this is, you keep really blowing my mind here on your ability to report things to us that I think most of us have not seen in the mainstream media. Thinking about the work that you've done this year, digging into it, it sounds traumatic to me, that the fact that other people aren't doing this work.
Well, I mean, I will say this. There are people who are doing this. It's just that nobody talks to them.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of the stuff I'm drawing from is information that's been drawn from an Asian sex workers collective called Red Canary Song, who were formed in response to an incident I'm about to talk about, which is, like, one of the most horrific things I've ever read about. The strong sexual violence content warning. So in 2016, a sex worker and immigrant named Ying Song is raped at gunpoint by an undercover cop. She goes to the police to report this. The police, you know, I wish I could say the police didn't do anything, because that would have been better than what they actually did, which was attempt to coerce her into becoming an informant. She refuses, and when she refuses to become an informant, they repeatedly set up sting operations to on her work to drag her out and humiliate her. And I mean, this goes on for ages. And eventually in 2017, they do another one of these sting operations. The police shows up and trying to escape them, she jumps out a window and dies.
Ugh.
And, you know, the police very directly drove her to her death. Like, after they raped her at gunpoint, and nothing, there was an investigation into this whole thing by the New York Police Department, did an investigation. They cleared everyone. Like, the undercover cop who raped her at gunpoint, nothing happened to any of the police involved in any of the raids.
Sure, of course. Why would, I mean, all they did was commit rape and murder. But
yeah,
cops,
you know, this has been happening. This kind of stuff has been happening for ages. And in the last 8 years, there's been a 1,500% increase in raids and arrests on Asian sex workers. And one of the things that they've been using this to do is collaborating with ICE and using this to do mass deportations in the guise of sort of fighting trafficking. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they're not fighting trafficking. Like these are the people who are abusing the sex workers. It's the cops. You know, this ties into a lot of there's been especially from sort of mainstream liberal Asian Americans, this call for these, you know, they want every single police department to have a hate crimes unit, and they want increased police presence. And, you know, Libby Shea, or Chef, what am I blanking on? The mayor of Oakland gave this speech after one of the attacks where she said, oh, this is why we can't defund the police.
Nope.
Because of these attacks.
Nope, that's not an example of why we shouldn't defund the police.
There's a lot of ways to look at this. One of it is that, like, the Oakland Police Department, like, their funding is the size of, like, a medium-sized military budget for, like, any other country.
Yeah.
And this is one of the most police cities in the world. And guess what? People are getting shot in the face with a flare gun in the streets, right? It doesn't do any. The cops don't care.
Yeah, if you're spending all this money, but you're not protecting your citizens.
Yeah, well, you know, it's almost like as been demonstrated over the summer that the point of the police is to kill and enslave black people and protect property, right? And occasionally on the side they do anti-Asian violence, and you know.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's got a side hustle, you know?
Yeah, there's another case of this that got also, like, somewhat, not that much coverage. Last year, there was a 19-year-old named Christian Hall, who, and I want to put something forward here, it's kind of important to talk about. He's an adoptee. A lot of people seem to think that adoptees get less racism or something because they're more assimilated. So he called the Pennsylvania police in December while having a mental health crisis. The police showed up, shot him, and then published a thing about how he had a gun and was pointing it at them. There's no gun. They just murdered him in cold blood. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, none of the stuff protected him. And, you know, these are the people who who Asian American liberals are saying should protect us.
Yeah.
It's like, no, these are the same. These are the same people who are killing us. Right. You can't solve it like this.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
I'm curious. Is there a lot? Is the Asian American community? I know we have to work on that label because it's so comprehensive, big. But reporting of crimes, is there a tendency to report crimes, or is that all packed in with part of this myth of the model minority of being good citizens and stuff like that? Because I from what I understand, there might be some cultural reticence to rock the boat. I don't know if I'm putting a fair words on this or whatever, but
I think there's two sort of conflicting tendencies here. Well, because the model minority thing is about, like, it's one specific group of Asian Americans who sort of get held up as, like, this thing, and, you know, they are able to enter the middle class and the professional class. And, yeah, those people you could argue, oh, they don't want to rock the boat, they want to report stuff. The reason most Asian people don't report crimes to the police is because the police hate them. And so, you know, like, this was the big thing in New York. Like, there's a bunch of Asian street vendors that the police attack constantly. I mean, just, like, beat the crap out of them. It's horrible stuff. And, you know, those people don't talk to the cops when hate crimes happen because the cops are doing hate crimes against them.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is where one of the really sinister effects of the sort of model minority myth is everyone, you know, it erases the fact that an extremely large number of Asian Americans are poor. And that those people, you know, they have no, they basically everyone, anytime they do any kind of political organizing, everyone just ignores them. And everyone just sort of assumes that, oh, like, whatever, they're secretly wealthy or something, or that, you know, or it's just the sort of, like, the rising Asian middle class, or, you know, Asian actors who get all of the sort of attention. And, you know, this has been a sort of, I think it's been a sort of crisis in the Asian American community, because, you know, that generation of professionals, like, genuinely believed that they could be assimilated into American society, right? That, you know, if they paid their dues, if they, you know, if they worked hard, right? That, and you know, and the other grim part about this is, you know, if they engage in anti-black violence, that they would be protected. But, you know, the problem with this is that the minority myth essentially turns Asian Americans into a stick. Right. And the white people use that stick to beat black people with. It's like, oh, if you just worked harder, if you had the culture of Asian Americans, like, if you too had an unbelievable amount of capital from when, you know, people fled the rise of the, like, the Communist Party in China, like, if you too had all of this, like, sort of, like, you know, they don't talk about that part, right? But it's like, you know, if you too, like, worked as hard as the Asians did, like, you wouldn't be poor. And it's like, no, but, you know, they're using us as a stick, right? But
yeah,
fundamentally, a stick is still a stick. It's not a person.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. you know, even if you're being held yes. above the heads of black people, like, the moment the stick is inconvenient, they're going to throw it away under a bus and you're going to snap.
You become a tool. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You're not a person. And a lot of people haven't realized this. And, you know, I think there's another very grim tendency of you get kinds of Asian nationalism that are based on this, where, like, if you remember, like, the riots in 92. Right, one of the things you see is Asian shopkeepers forming these like basically proto-fascist paramilitaries.
And you'll see among the far right, Boogaloo Boys and Nazis, the term rooftop Koreans, often with like an image of like Asian business owners in Los Angeles on their roofs with rifles. Yeah, it's a big, a very common term that kind of unites the kind of libertarian far right with the explicitly Nazi mm-hmm. far right. Yeah, absolutely.
And one of the things that's scary about there's a lot of things that are scary about this. One is that there are people who still want that, right? Like there are business owners whose thing is like they're racist and they look at this and go, our ticket into the American project, right, is we're gonna help the white people like keep black people in line. We're gonna murder them, we're gonna become paramilitaries, we're gonna do all of this stuff again, we're gonna frame it in the terms of sort of community self-defense, blah 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 blah. But you know, they're just These are just the racist nationalists who want a race war, right? They're not really fundamentally different than the white nationalists. And the second thing that's scary about this is you see a lot of people in this moment attempting to use there's always been a sort of, there's like a, you know, the Asian American community is like any other community. There's always right wing currents, there's left wing currents in it. They're just, you know, we're people, we have different politics. The Asian American has its own men's rights movement who are,
oh God.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, who are, they're exactly what you'd expect from a men's rights movement, but they also have this, they're obsessed with the fact that like, it's not just that women won't date them. It's that Asian women won't date them.
Oh okay. No.
Yeah. They're awful. They suck. I do not give anyone who's doing this the time of day. And, but you know, the Nazi right is recruiting from these people as the sort of mm-hmm. attacks come on. They're doing it incredibly like very, I've seen like sort of screencasts of them doing this in very sophisticated ways because, you know, what we're seeing right now is the failure of the sort of like of the people who genuinely believe the model minority myth of the sort of, I guess you call it the assimilationist tendency or the mm-hmm. tendency of, you know, we can integrate with the American state, and we can become wealthy together. That's collapsing. And in its wake, you're seeing, you know, the advance of the far right. And you're also seeing, like, I get, you know, like you can call them tankies, but that's sort of not what's going on with some of these people. There's a lot of people who've been driven basically to Chinese nationalism in response to just, you know, the absolute horror at the fact that we were being murdered in the streets, right? Mm-hmm. And that's grim in its own way because, you know, the CCP doesn't, they don't care about us. Like, the U.S. could kill every single Asian American. And as long as the rate of returns were maintained, as long as American capital kept flowing into China, the CCP wouldn't care. But there's a lot of people who genuinely believe that if they defend the CCP, because they're also buying in fundamentally to the sort of the conflation of race, nation, state, right?
Yeah.
And like people that the nationalist stuff is based on. And they believe that if they can convince Americans that the CCP is good, that people won't be racist against them anymore. And it won't work. And it's like, I feel for them. Like, I really do. But That's not going to work. The actual racism is sort of baked into just the core of the American project. It's not something that can be changed by geopolitics. It's not something that can, you know, it's not something that can be changed by that. And the CCP isn't coming to save you, right? No one is. And that's an incredibly grim thing to realize, right? That, you know, sort of liberal norms aren't going to protect us, like, There's no one outside sort of coming to save us. It's just us.
And it can drive people to these different corners because it's so ineffective in doing that.
Well, and that's, I think a lot of the, and we're getting well off the topic of violence against Asian Americans when we get into this, but I think one of the things that is the biggest problem on the left right now is you have this tremendous amount of division that's based, you know, there's a lot that goes into it, including disinformation, but a lot of it comes down to a lot of leftists want to believe that there's someone out there who's either coming mm-hmm. to save them or who, if they emulate that nation, whatever, that party, effectively enough, it will save them. And like, it's I understand the desire, right? I understand the desire to want to think that, look, if we just do what the Soviets did, right, this will fix all of our problems. And it's like, no, they murdered the biggest freshwater lake in continental Europe, making bombs too. Like it didn't save anyone. There's no one coming to save us.
I think specifically with that, this is what's so depressing about the sort of Chinese nationalist turn is that we tried this. There were two different left-wing nationalist parties in China. Mm-hmm. One of them, you know, is the Nationalist Party, the Kuomintang, run by Chiang Kai-shek, right? And, you know, he was like the model of the left-wing national liberation person until in 1927, like, there's a revolution in Shanghai and, you know, the workers take the city. And Chiang Kai-shek goes, wait, oh God. What do you mean, like, Chinese workers want to be able to, like, run their own country by their own unions, mm-hmm. by their own factory councils? And he just murders them all. It was a huge massacre. And then, you know, by the end of the 30s, Chiang Kai-shek is calling himself Generalissimo and is allied with Hitler, right?
Yeah.
And then you have the CCP, and the CCP does a very similar thing. It's, they're a left-wing group. And then they pivot, they ally with the U.S., they invade Vietnam. And, you know, by the time you hit now, right, there's, you know, you read these reports about, I mean, what are Chinese workers going through? You know, I was talking to my family yesterday, and there's an old Chinese greeting that is, when you greet someone, you ask them, have they eaten yet? And, you know, you're kind of supposed to say, like, yeah, I've eaten. But, like, you know, if you say no, like, if you say you haven't eaten, like, you will be fed. Like, yeah. You can't get out of it. You're like, yeah, right. So in like, I think in, like, the 60s, the Maoists tried to change this to, have you worked yet? And this was, like, a fiasco. Mm. It didn't work. No one was going to walk up to someone and say, have you worked yet, right?
You don't just change something like that.
Yeah, well, but the grim thing is that there has been a sort of, and some of it's kind of ironic, but, like, people now asking each other, have you slept yet? Because China has...
Like,
no, it's grim. The reason they're doing this is because China has a thing called 996, which is it's a work schedule where you work from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Yeah, and this is why it's happening. And that's not even the worst of it. Right? There's a bunch of reports about Chinese delivery drivers, right? And these people are working 14 hours a day. They're making basically nothing. I mean, it's got to the point where these people started lighting themselves on fire because they literally couldn't take mm-hmm. it anymore because, you know, you work 14 hours a day, you can't keep your family alive, and then the company steals from you.
Yeah.
Right? And but you know, if you look at this, right, this is incredibly similar to what American delivery drivers are going through right now, many of whom are also mm-hmm. Asian, right? It's like, you know, they're our government has decided to feed them into a pandemic, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not entirely dissimilar from farmers in the Indian subcontinent drinking pesticides,
yeah.
You know, as a protest. Like, it's this, it's,
yeah.
These are all the results of inhuman systems forcing people into misery for profit.
Forcing people to live in an inhumane capacity.
Yeah.
Like, that's not a sustainable endeavor working
yeah,
like
sorry,
that.
Yeah, sorry,
No, but like, you know, this is one of the most depressing things about anti-Chinese racism, anti-Asian racism, and you saw this with anti-Japanese racism in the 80s, where, you know, when the American economy falls apart, you can blame the Japanese economy, mm-hmm. right? I mean, in the 80s, like, okay, the thing that destroyed the American economy in the 80s was that Reagan decided he was going to raise interest rates and specifically attempting to raise unemployment to 20%, right? Reagan gutted the country, but, you know, the UAW and a lot of the auto workers in Detroit who are seeing, you know, that they're getting blown out by sort of by Japanese imports, like people blame Japan, and there's these attacks on Japanese people. Eventually, this is one of the starts of the Asian Civil Rights Movement. They murder this dude named Vincent Chin, who's not Japanese. He's just a guy. And, you know, When the nascent Asian American civil rights movement goes to talk to the UAW, the head of the UAW local says, yeah, we'll back you because he's not Japanese, but if he was Japanese, it would be understandable. Oh, wow. And it's so depressing. It's how cynical this is, right? Like This is it's a completely cynical thing by the American ruling class. It is at its core, like, it is the most pure example of, we can get these workers who are unemployed because the government has screwed them, because capitalism has screwed them. We can get them to blame Asians. We can get them to blame the Japanese people. Right now, you see this with China. It's like, we can blame China for the pandemic, right? When in reality, mm-hmm. it was the American government fed 500,000 people to a plague.
Yeah.
But, you know, we can blame the Chinese for it. And you know, Chinese workers are suffering under exactly the same, but, you know, in a lot of ways worse, like, conditions that American workers are. But you can't get people to understand this, because, you know, this is one of the purposes of sort of anti-Asian racism, is to obscure the fact that fundamentally, you know, and I don't want to get sort of too much into the we're all in this together, because, you know, like, there's lots of violence going on here in a lot of different ways, but, like,
yeah.
Like, you know, the factory workers who are dying in China are, there's basically no difference between them and the factory workers who are dying of plagues in the U.S. The people who are dying in meat factories, right? There's no difference between them. It's just, you know, like, we're all just workers getting just absolutely stamped on by a bunch of people who, you know, by the parts of the U.S. and China who are having a race to see who can hit the most billionaires. Yeah. And it's... You know, and you know, and the you know, the way that these sort of, you call them economic contradictions, are resolved is, instead of doing anything about them, we kill Asian Americans.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
So, I'm not going to ask how do we solve the broader problem of, you know, how atomized the working class is globally. I will ask, what can be done, like, in the face of this very immediate problem of a surge of violence in the United States against Asian Americans? Like, what can people listening, or should, like, is there any... Yeah, I don't know. That's my question. Like, what do we...
Yeah. I
do
guess...
Do you have any advice?
The first thing I would say is, anyone who's offering you a magic cure is trying to sell you something. Like, there's a lot of people, you know, every time one of these things happens, right, there's, you know, there's all these lists of organizations and stuff, and they'll mm-hmm. be like, oh, donate to this place. I mean, I'm not saying, like, you know, there are people who need your money, right? But, like, you know, that's not going to actually solve this. Like, one of the common ones is, like, order from Chinese restaurants. And it's like, okay, that's not yeah. going to... Right. You know,
yeah.
I would argue mm-hmm. Some of the street violence, you know, there were solutions that were easier back in, like, February of last year. Right. Things could have been, you know, if people had just, like whenever someone on Fox News talked about a bat or, like, the Wuhan mm-hmm. flu, if people had just, like, destroyed, like, buried Tucker Carlson's career for it. Right. Like, if people had, like,
that would have been nice.
Yeah. You know, but now. Now, like, this is probably going to continue for a while, and, you know, I mean, I could say there have been a few sort of inspiring things that are grim in their own ways, where, you know, people have been being attacked, and, like, whole communities have gotten together to, like, show up to defend their houses, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that kind of, like, the only actual way out of this, and this is also something that the Asian American community has to do, which is incredibly grim, but, you know, we have to actually organize ourselves, and we have to, I mean, you know, when I say organize our communities, we have to organize everyone in our communities, right? And and, you know, this is what's hard about it, because a lot of the stuff that needs to be done, sort of, well, a lot of it, you know, if you want to deal with, like, police violence, right, like police violence against Asian Americans, which is a very serious problem, you know, that requires actual structural change in a way that you can't just sort of snap your fingers and do, like, you know, like the best you can do on that front is do what happened over the summer again, but even that, like, didn't happen. So I guess really what I'm getting at is, there's no easy solutions to this. It's probably going to involve things like finding out who in your local community actually needs help and, you know, doing escorts for like elderly Asian American people. It's going to mean having, you know, doing mutual aid. Is going to mean having response networks that are independent of the state, because again, and I cannot emphasize this enough, the police don't care, or, you know, it's best when they don't care, because most of the time they just make everything worse.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I know that's not like what the answers people are looking for, but.
No. Well, no. It's something though, but.
It's an answer.
It's the answer. And I'll just say for my part, I feel. Thank you for this conversation. Thank you so much. Because I know that this is a lot of responsibility. You're talking to a bunch of white people about stuff that's very personal, and we're learning. And I feel really acutely aware of that, and that I want to be doing better on my part, to be doing my research on my own independently. And I encourage all of our listeners to be doing that, to be including this perspective in our anti-racist work, because it's all connected. And I think that for a long time, like, why doesn't this stuff break the surface? Well, you know, we haven't considered. I mean, like, I know that there's been anti-Asian racism and violence and all this stuff for a long time. But, you know, as we're talking about all of these race conversations, this just has to be a forefront, especially right now. So I really do appreciate your time chatting with us about it.
Thank you for giving me a place to speak about this. It's, you know, one of the things that was the most isolating, especially like in you know, February of 2020, was that you couldn't even talk about the racism, because anytime you tried, everyone immediately pulled out a loyalty test and was like, are you pro or anti-CCP? And it was like, that, no, like, we're getting killed. Like, please stop this. And I'm, you know, as grim as everything else is, I'm glad we're finally getting to a place where, you know, we can actually talk about this in a way that's not sort of, you know, that in a way that's actually about Asian Americans and not about sort of whatever weird geopolitical alignment stuff is sort of going on in the background.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you. I wish there was, like, I don't know, something upbeat. We'll figure positive. Out an upbeat.
You know,
thing.
I can tell one story that was upbeat, like, very
okay. Upbeat. Yes, please.
Okay, so it's in the 1870s, 1880s. All of organized labor absolutely hates Chinese people, like, just despises them. But by the time of the 1900s, though, there is one group. Exactly one union who will actually organize Chinese workers, and is the Industrial Workers of the World.
Hell
the
yeah.
Wobblies. Yeah, they're the only ones. The Wobblies. Everyone else is just like, screw Chinese people. But the Wobblies, and the Wobblies are interesting because they're again, you know, they're the only union who genuinely believes in, you know, like the principles of the working class, the principles of things like Workers of the World Unite. Like, they, you know, so they organize white workers, they organize black workers, they organize a lot of Mexican workers, to the point where, like, you know, they briefly take over, like, a bunch of cities in Texas and in, like, northern Mexico at the beginning of the Mexican Revolution. And, you know, that sort of, like, that kind of stuff, the, you know, that kind of politics of sort of really radical unionism, of direct democracy, of, you know, interracial organizing, that was scary enough that the U.S. just turned its giant eradicator cannon on and was like, we need to destroy these people.
Mm-hmm. They and, sure,
you know,
did.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, eventually they do.
That's
this.
What
but,
they
you
do.
Know, yeah. Yeah, but, like, you know, the IWW gets credit for, they're the only people who even tried. And, you know, if there had been more people now, if there were more people then who'd been Wobblies, who'd been, you know, willing to do that kind of work, like, we wouldn't be in this mess. But, you know, this kind of solidarity is something that's possible to build.
Yeah.
It's just extremely difficult. And it requires, you know, a lot of community organizing, a lot of people, a lot of people pulling out chairs from meetings and writing lists and stuff. Like,
yeah.
A lot of grim, dull, painful work.
Well,
positive, hopeful work, maybe, if we do it, though.
Go out there, do some grim, dull, painful work. I don't know. I think in general, we can sign these episodes off by saying, fuck the cops.
That's fair.
When discussing most social issues.
Tell people where they can find you online one more time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm... So my ad is it me, CHR3, but it's also... It's just Ice Must Be Destroyed.
Yeah.
I have a Substack that I write on sometimes. It's called The Long 21st Century. And I also just... I want to thank my friend Jack for helping with this. Jack, you know who you are. You're great. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack.
Thank you, Jack.
All right.
Well, all right. That's going to bring us to an end for this episode. So please... I don't know. Think about some shit. Just keep thinking about shit.
Doing things too.
Everything's so dumb. Everything's so dumb, and it's gonna get dumber.
Great.
I tried.
Yes.
Daniel.
Lovely.
Worst Year Ever is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.